What does it take to succeed in America, and are some groups more likely to succeed than others? Sandra Singh Lowe joins us to talk about her cover review of two books, The Triple Package by Amy Chua and Jed Rubenfeld, and The Hybrid Tiger by Kuan Yu Huang.
The whole notion of success is something to look at and say, what does that really mean with our kids in a brand new world and brand new economy?
How and why did eight ordinary Americans break into an FBI office in 1971 and expose Hoover's methods? Betty Metzger is here to talk about her new book, The Burglary, The Discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's Secret FBI.
The Catholic peace movement, beginning in 1969, had moved from nonviolent aggressive actions to where you went into draft boards in the dark of night and actually took out records in the hope of damaging the draft board's ability to draft as many men and send them to Vietnam.
Julie Bosman will be here with Notes from the Field, and Greg Coles has bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul. Sandra Singh Lowe is joining us from L.A. to talk about her cover review of two new books, one you may have been hearing about, The Triple Package, How Three Unlikely Traits Explain the Rise and Fall of Cultural Groups in America, by Amy Chua and Jed Rubenfeld. The other, The Hybrid Tiger, Secrets of the Extraordinary Success of Asian American Kids, by Kuan Yu Huang. Hi, Sandra.
Hi.
Thanks so much for joining us. Tell us about these two books.
Well, I think it's, you know, the Chinese are back. I mean, I'm half Chinese myself. I'm Chinese German. So I sort of feel like I'm at home in the Chinese world. And I think there's always a sort of a foreignness or alienness when we talk about China from the U.S. that I think sort of inspires both the fascination and sometimes the terror that these sorts of books bring up. What we're looking at is, you know, Chinese children versus American children. And we have this image of these Asian children being sort of these perfect violin-playing prodigies, and they can do calculus at 12, and they're amazing and a little bit frightening with their level of excellence. And American kids are, of course, the slackers. I look at my tween daughters, and I...
they got the American part,
American,
not the Chinese.
Sort of goth way. But I think Kuan Yu Huang's book, The Hybrid Tiger, it's sort of a kinder, gentler version of the tiger parenting phenomena, where he says, well, actually, look, back in China, and he spends a lot of time there because he's a native Chinese person, we think about our Chinese children and we worry about them because, yes, their test scores are amazing. They outscore American children in science and math phenomenally, and there's no question there. But something changes when they get in their 20s and older, where suddenly you see the fact that there are no Nobel Prizes in math and science that have ever come out of a Chinese higher institution. And there has been no, you know, Bill Gates, no Steve Jobs, so that, you know, that sort of innovation, creativity, those just aren't catchphrases. At some point, you start living the fruits of that when you get, you know, after grade school, after K-12, you start seeing these shifts. And that's a fascinating thing to look at.
Why does Kuan Yu Huang have an argument or a hypothesis as to why this is? Why is it this, you know, incredible run of achievement and then afterwards no Nobel Prizes?
I mean, I think if you look at Chinese schooling, where, you know, the comparison between American and Chinese students, they go to school like at 7 in the morning and come back at 9 o'clock at night and then have homework. So there are many more hours in school, and they have many more hours of homework. So they're really good at sitting and drilling, which is not necessarily a bad word. I mean, sometimes you have to sit with, like, math for a long time to get it. But this notion of what creativity and innovation is, he tells this wonderful story at the beginning of the book when he's a new teacher coming just from China in the American classroom. And he's talking to this group of, I think, kindergartners. And he is horrified because they seem wiggling in their chairs, shifty-eyed. They don't show the reverence for the teacher that he would have had in China. And he starts telling them a little bit about his work in China, and he can tell that he's not being very interesting to them and their attention's wandering, et cetera, et cetera. And then he stops, and then the teacher says, any questions? And he was amazed that all these hands shot up, and these kids came to life. And they said, well, how would you compare life in China to Japan, which is something he had been talking to his own family about. And they asked a bunch of questions where he said Chinese children, it would never have occurred to them to ask these questions.
Right.
Been allowed, that I think that in kernel is part of what he's talking about.
Yes. I mean, it's interesting that you bring in Japan, too. And I, having taught very briefly in Thailand, observed this same phenomenon. So I don't know if it's a uniquely Chinese thing or a broader Asian or certain countries in Asia. But and that, I guess, making broad general cultural arguments brings us to the other book, which is, we should mention, for those who don't know, by the author of The Battle Hymn of the Tiger Mother and Her Husband, Jed Rubenfeld, an author in his own right, both of them professors at Yale Law School. What are they arguing in their new book, The Triple Package?
Well, they're saying that although they keep saying it's taboo to say, but they say it for a whole book, which is kind of one of the funny semantic dances they do, that there are certain, well, they call them culture groups, but ethnic groups, tribes that do better than others in America. And there's a long list that has, you know, sort of Asians and Jews and sort of Nigerians are an interesting pocket, Mormons sort of after polygamy, that do better either by financially or academically or in a bunch of metrics that they throw in there. They have three elements to their success, and one is kind of a little bit of a superiority complex. Our tribe is a little better than everyone else's tribe. I would think, in my case, it's like the Chinese were better. The second is a sense of inferiority that we could fall off at any point.
Right.
So we've got to keep trying. Unlike the WASPs, and they were talking about Tad Friend's Cheerful Money, which is a hilarious and great book about, you know, WASPs just on a slow decline as they sit with a tumbler of scotch watching our Holsteins eat up the entire family's fortune on the beautiful grassy hill. It's a great image. And then the third is impulse control, which means, you know, you work really hard, especially when things get tough, you don't give up. So those are the three elements.
Marshmallow test. Do they cite that marshmallow test? It's like the one study about like impulse control and waiting. And
yeah, that's the one that they have. And in a very sort of difficult way. And I think that's why I, you know, when I reviewed the piece, I had a little bit of difficulty in this book because I felt uncomfortable a lot of the time. Like, for instance, they're talking about impulse control in Appalachia. And you're almost going, oh, no, please don't go to Appalachia. Please don't beat up on those poor Appalachians anymore. They'll talk about, oh, but unfortunately, kind of like they take pills and methamphetamine and they're called pillbillies, but we don't call them that. They do. So I think it becomes a little bit uncomfortable because not only do you have to then look at groups that aren't doing as well, but in a very, you know, sort of sympathetic way, but it's almost a truism. I felt a little bit of kind of like you wouldn't think successful groups, the three traits of successful groups are they're alcoholics, they sleep till noon.
Right.
I found at the end I was learning more as I was reading this book. It was sort of making the same case over and over again.
So very much sort of an argument book, a kind of op-ed type of.
Yeah. That kind of may have been an article long piece. And so for me, you know, it went on and on. I have to say, there's been such a firestorm about this when it came out, and
it hasn't even come out yet.
I know,
but it's already
come out, and people who haven't even read it are saying, "Oh my God, it's so racist! It's the new racism!" And I don't even think that you can make that, you know, that volatile an accusation. It's a pretty dry academic book. In fact, it was much more dry than I thought because, you know, whatever you might think about our super couple of Yale law professors, the Tiger Mom and the Tiger Dad, they're rarely boring.
Right.
And the Tiger Mom book, you know, it's a pretty compelling, it's a pretty fast read, whatever you think. And this book was quite dry and academic.
And Rubenfeld is a suspense novelist on the side.
Yeah,
as well.
And he writes really dishy, erotic asphyxiation stuff. And they both like know how to write, you know, page turners, but this book wasn't. So if people want to read it, they should, but it's a pretty dry read and you pretty much get it in the first chapter.
Were there any surprises for you?
I think, you know, the more in this book, maybe the little bit of the Nigerians, the Mormons, they talk about the Mormons when you suddenly realize, oh, yeah, not from Mitt Romney, but I want to say the guy who starred in Napoleon Dynamite, that actor, oh, he's a Mormon. There's some surprises as to who successful people from a range of different fields who are Mormons.
But they qualify it as post-polygamous Mormons. Why?
Yes, post-polygamous. Well, impulse control.
Ah, yes, yes. There we go.
Once they started shoring themselves up, like thinking, how are we going to be like sort of more successful in America? We're not going to be polygamous. We're not going to break the rules. We're going to focus down, just have the one wife. You know, it was almost a sense of like refocusing themselves to just be really good businessmen, et cetera, like Mitt Romney is. So, and I think that's why when you're reading this book, and I was reading it, I was going, why is I'm just dragging myself from page to page, mm-hmm. because they have to keep showing exemplary examples that maybe Appalachians or Mormons in their polygamous states may make better reads or be more interesting characters. But those aren't really the stars of this book.
I mean, one thing that I found interesting about the two books is this focus on success. I believe that Chua and Rubenfeld have a kind of caveat chapter, sort of the downsides to this kind of success.
Right.
But is there another kind of book to be written about this whole notion of success and culture?
I love that question, Pamela, because had I had another 7,000 words for the review, I think so. And I felt in reading these two books that, and I did really enjoy the Kuan Yu Huang book. He is such a humanist and so delightful and so full of surprises. I really enjoyed that. You know, and I think that we all then, you know, gaze back at our own children, and I am very ambivalent about, you know, even academic success. Of in our day, I'm 51, back in my day, it's, you know, I had a Chinese father. He says, do really well in math and science, and then you will become an aerospace engineer, and you'll have a career forever. And, of course, shortly thereafter, aerospace, it fell through the floor, that whole industry. And I think that when you look at kids today, it's you look at some of, like, doctors, lawyers, I mean, the amount of law degrees, the amount they cost, and then the amount of jobs that are being lost. One is ambivalent to know what academic success really means.
Right.
And I think, for instance, in the Hybrid Tiger book, when he's talking about Chinese parents want their kids to be a doctor, lawyer, an accountant, and I'm like going, do I really want my kids want to be an accountant? Because I am sort of the bohemian kind of creative class tribe. Creative class parents have a whole different notion about what success is.
But then they could do your taxes for them.
And play the oboe.
Right.
That would be great. You know, so I think that one of the reasons that Western parents, and it's true that we're more friends with our children, and we don't make them practice piano for 5 hours until they're leaving teeth marks on the piano, like Amy Chua's daughter. But it's sort of, A, of course, because we're lazy and we'd rather go to the spa. I'm kidding. But that is an argument that she makes, that Western mothers are really lazy. But I think at my core, I'm ambivalent about whether they need to be a concert pianist, whether they need to be 2 years ahead in math. I was 2 years ahead in math. I went to Caltech, got my degree, and, you know, guess what? A couple decades later, these geniuses are doing, like, the computers on how much beer to put in the beer guns at Applebee's.
Right.
You know, it's kind of like, sometimes you can be really bright at math, and then nothing happens, and you don't really amount to doing stuff that's very interesting in the world. So, yeah, I think the whole notion of success is something to look at and say, what does that really mean with our kids in a brand new world and brand new economy?
All right. Well, this raises about 20 other questions that we don't have time to ask, but I'm sure many listeners will ponder when reading the review and perhaps as well the books. Sandra, thank you so much for coming on.
My pleasure, Pamela.
Julie Bosman joins us with Notes from the Field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, Pamela.
So the latest thing in book clubs is having the author join in the discussion.
Yes, this is a new twist on the traditional book club, which, as you know, you get a bunch of friends or acquaintances together on a regular basis, open a bottle of Chardonnay, and talk about the book in complete candor. And what I wrote about this week is a new venture called Book the Writer, which was started by a novelist, and it involves inviting an author to visit your book club and paying $750 for the privilege.
Each person in the book club pays $750, or the club altogether pays $750?
The club altogether pays $750, and this service has signed up authors to be on sort of a roster to be available. And it's only in New York, only in...
I was going to say, are they coming to Omaha anytime soon?
No, it doesn't exactly fit the business model at the moment. And really, New York is the only place that this could possibly exist. It's full of local writers. It's full of best-selling, well-known writers. And it's also full of a lot of readers.
Well, if something tells me San Francisco might not fare so bad...
San Francisco could probably do it, but New York definitely has a critical mass. And I visited one of these book clubs that was actually the first one to invite an author. And Alexandra Styron, who, of course, wrote a memoir of growing up with her father, William Styron, appeared. And it was interesting. It didn't quite feel like a book club meeting. It felt more like being at a bookstore when the author is there to answer questions. Why did you write the
book?
Right,
the reading with the Q&A afterward.
Exactly. I mean, it looked like a book club, but it didn't feel like one. The novelist who started the service, Jean Korolitz, wrote the book Admission, which was turned into a movie starring Tina Fey a year or two ago. She signed on a lot of authors, Kurt Anderson, Zoe Heller, Michael Cunningham, all people who live in New York and are available to pop into a book club one evening. Jean Korolitz, the novelist who started the service, said that she wanted to do it because she had always had a lot of book club meetings when she lived in Princeton, New Jersey. She had always invited authors to come down on New Jersey Transit or drive into the city and visit her book club, and they had always done it for free. But when she moved into Manhattan, she decided to try to extend it into something a little bit more formal. And in her mind, this is something that can help an author earn a little bit extra money. We know that we are in a world where advances are not quite as big as they used to be for most mid-list authors. And a lot of authors, even the best-selling ones, just don't make as much as they used to. So this is a little bit of pocket change for an author. And it also highlights how important book clubs are to publishers and to authors. Publishers have done a lot more focus on finding book clubs, on cultivating them, on sending galleys to book clubs early. So this is really an extension of that.
Kevin Baker, the novelist, wrote a very funny piece for the Book Review recently about showing up to a book club meeting uninvited, thinking that the members were in for a very exciting surprise, only to find that they didn't like his book so much. So presumably at these meetings we're talking about, there's not too much criticism and bad-mouthing going on with the author in question present.
It's a little bit more civilized. I mean, I think that was a great piece, and that was what happens when an author just crashes a book club meeting or a
reading. Do not try this at home.
And he really got some unadulterated opinions about what people thought of his book, and not all of them were enthusiastic about it. So at least the book club that I sat in on, there weren't a lot of people who were saying, gee, I really hated this book. Why did you even bother? It was very cordial, very nice. And I think that there were a lot of people who said that they adored the book, and it was a very good book. So perhaps they were not just saying that to be nice.
Well, I suspect we may hear mean comments from listeners in the many cities other than New York and San Francisco that believe, and perhaps rightfully so, that they could sustain this model. So perhaps it'll become a nationwide phenomenon.
Thanks. I promise to report on it in that case.
Thanks, Julie.
Thanks.
Betty Metzger is here to talk about her new book, The Burglary, The Discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's Secret FBI. Hi, Betty.
Hi.
So,
thank you for inviting me.
Oh, it's great to have you. The story that you talk about in this book was the subject already of two New York Times pieces about the discoveries you made with your research. But for those who did not read the front page story or the video story on our website, what is this book about? What is the break-in? What was the burglary?
Well, the story is about the burglars themselves who have been secret, silent, for 43 years. and have just come out in the book and in the stories that have been written. The burglary occurred on the night of March 8, 1971. It was the burglary of a small FBI office in Media, Pennsylvania, an old suburb west of Philadelphia. And the kind of thing that anybody, I think, would have thought was an extremely foolish thing to do. The FBI seemed all powerful. J. Edgar Hoover, the director of the FBI then for half century, was practically worshipped by the American public. But these people, led by William Davidson, a physics professor, believed that the FBI was suppressing dissent.
There were eight of them.
There were eight of them. I found seven of them. Seven of them cooperated with being interviewed for the book. The leader of the group, Mr. Davidson, unfortunately died last November. But they believed that the FBI was probably infiltrating all kinds of activist groups at that time, but that nothing could be done about the suppression of dissent unless you had solid evidence. And he got the idea that the only way that you could do that was to burglarize an office. He hated the idea, and so did they. But he thought that given the way Hoover was worshipped and the power that he had and the total lack of oversight by Congress and by his boss, the Attorney General and the President, that there was no way to find out.
They were very unlikely burglars, this group of eight. You have this college professor, grad students. Some of them had young children. How did they get together? What were they part of an organization that I know that they were anti-war activists, right? But how did they sort of come together and get themselves, you know, geared up to break into an FBI office, which sounds like it would be a kind of daunting task?
Yeah. Now, that's true. I mean, if you saw them today or then,
right,
they would seem like a very unlikely group of burglars. It probably is important to say that the anti-war movement was very large and encompassed quite a wide variety of people. The feelings against a war cut across all kinds of lines by that time. Each of them had experience at least once in burglarizing a draft board by that time.
Mm-hmm. So they were experienced burglars.
They were slightly experienced burglars. I mean, they had to train themselves more in order to do this. But each of them also was part of the Catholic peace movement, although only one of the eight was a Catholic. But the Catholic peace movement, beginning in 1969, had moved from nonviolent aggressive actions where you stood by and waited to be arrested to where you went into draft boards in the dark of night and actually took out records in the hope of damaging the draft board's ability to draft as many men and send them to Vietnam. So they had been part of that movement, mm-hmm. and that's what gave them the initial skills of burglary.
I mean, it seems that when you look back at the 1970s, all kinds of crimes were much easier, from hijacking airplanes to breaking into the FBI. There wasn't actually a lot of security in this particular office building.
There wasn't, although there's an ironic reason for the fact that there wasn't more security in this FBI office. The previous fall, well, first of all, I should say that they found there were no alarm systems, and one of them, Bonnie Raines, an operator of a daycare center, had gone.
Watch out for those daycare center operators.
That's right. Had posed as a college student and gone in and interviewed the agent in charge of the office and had been trained by one of the members of the group to look for signs of an alarm system, found none, also found that the cabinets were unlocked, the file cabinets. But the reason that was the case is the fact that the agent in charge of the office, Tom Lewis, had in fact asked for more security. He wanted an alarm system installed. He wanted the office to be connected with the local police station, and had asked the central office in Washington for file cabinet versions of safes so that they could keep all their papers under lock and key, and had been turned down for that. Interesting, the person who turned him down was Mark Felt, the future deep throat of Watergate fame. Without his rejection of those requests, the media burglary could never have taken place.
What did they find?
They were looking for evidence, whether there was evidence of dissent. And they found that in much greater volume and severity than they expected. One of the first files that I received when they sent the files to me at the Washington Post.
This was when you were a reporter there at the time.
I was a reporter at the Washington Post, and I was one of the people they sent the files to. And in the first group I received, there was a file that instructed FBI agents to act in such a way that they would enhance the paranoia and that people would think that there was an FBI agent behind every mailbox. That was a pretty stunning set of descriptions of what they wanted to accomplish.
Right.
And those statements really shocked the public. Immediately, there were calls by several members of Congress for investigations of the FBI and by major newspaper editorial writers, including the New York Times. That had not happened before. And it's hard to overestimate how idolized Hoover was before and that he's had very, very little public criticism.
And the most important thing they found was something called COINTELPRO.
There were many important documents. In the end, the most important one was a simple label, that a filing label called COINTELPRO that was atop an article that the FBI wanted distributed to college administrators on how to control students who were opposing the war. And we who received it didn't know what COINTELPRO was. And the FBI, I now know from reading the investigation of the burglary, the FBI officials in Washington were waiting to see if that one piece of paper would be released. Mm-hmm. And they were very upset when it was, because it meant that now that term was outside the Bureau for the first time.
And what did that term mean?
It referred to a counterintelligence program that Hoover had opened in 1956, first against communists and then against black people and then against New Left. And one small part of it was against the Ku Klux Klan in the mid-1960s. These were dirty tricks operations, but that's an inadequate way to describe them, really. They were intended to disrupt and in some cases destroy individuals and organizations. I describe them as ranging from crude to cruel, and that's not quite adequate. When I crude, I mean there were such things as dirty tricks to fill oranges, inject oranges of activists, informer inject oranges with laxatives that they knew activists were going to eat. But then on the other end, some of these actions led to murders.
Yes.
For instance, in the case of Fred Hampton, a Black Panther in Chicago, an FBI informer under this program followed Fred Hampton, associated with him, and drew a map of his apartment where his bed was, labeled Fred's bed, so that a shooter for the Chicago police could go into the apartment and kill, as he did, Fred Hampton in his sleep. And to just show how the FBI regarded such things afterwards, that informer was praised in a memorandum and was given a bonus for his role in causing that to happen. And with numerous other cases, the FBI engaged informers who then gave false testimony that sent people to prison for decades, including Geronimo Pratt in Los Angeles. The same thing happened at times outside of COINTELPRO operations, as with some cases in Boston of people falsely accused of murdering in organized crime operations.
And so when you received all these documents, did you immediately understand the scope of what there was in this cache of documents? And was there a controversy within the Washington Post about whether they should be published? And, I mean, given the status of the FBI at the time?
There was a controversy. I wasn't aware of it until that afternoon after I had written my story. And it's a good question about the scope. It was not possible to realize the scope of what the files meant from that first group. except for the one thing that was pretty clear, and that is that within the media files were files that described the surveillance of African Americans, mm-hmm. which was quite different from the surveillance of other people. I mean, the surveillance of professors and students and anti-war activists in general was explicit and described, but they were usually under surveillance because of something that they thought or expressed, and of course that's outrageous. But it was even worse. I mean, for blacks, it was enough simply to be black. You were considered dangerous and you could come under surveillance. And the files did describe blanket surveillance of African-American communities in Philadelphia in detail, but also contained the evidence that showed that in the whole country, every FBI agent, for instance, was required to have at least one informer who reported to them regularly on their surveillance of African Americans. And in Washington, D.C., every FBI agent was required to hire six informers who reported to them regularly on the activities of African Americans. And this did not just mean militant people, but black communities. Now, the controversy inside the Washington Post, this was the first time that a journalist had received secret government documents from someone outside the government who had stolen those files. So that, of course, as far as the publisher, Katharine Graham, was concerned, that raised issues that had never been raised before. The first instance in which Katharine Graham, publisher of the Washington Post, was asked by the Nixon administration to suppress a story. And, of course, she went on just 3 months later to publish the Pentagon and after that, many Watergate stories that they also wanted suppressed. There was quite a debate within the Washington Post that afternoon as I was writing, where the editors were fully supportive and thought that this was important information that the public needed to know. And she was reluctant, but by 10 o'clock that night, made the decision to publish, and it was on the front page the next morning.
There's so many fascinating and disturbing aspects to the story, but I want to fast forward 40 years later, plus. These guys were never discovered until a dinner that you had with people involved. Can you tell that story, and how did you come back to this burglary?
They evaded discovery despite the fact that there were 200 FBI agents looking for them immediately after the burglary.
That's probably the more alarming, you know, aspect. Not that they were caught, that they weren't caught in the process, but then that they could never find them after the FBI, you would think.
Well, there are various reasons for that. And it's interesting, as burglars have been interviewed recently, and one of them has said something pretty important, I think, and that is that the peace movement in Philadelphia was so vast and so many people there were under suspicion by the FBI for this, that helped them sink into their normal lives. But nevertheless, it was a massive investigation that it resulted in another trial where the FBI thought the people they had arrested in another case were the burglars, and they weren't. I found the media burglars quite by accident. I was living in California and spent a weekend in Philadelphia where I met with various acquaintances and friends I had known there when I was a reporter in Philadelphia in the late 1960s. And one of the meetings I had was at the home of John and Bonnie Raines, whom I had known earlier. And in the course of the evening, when their youngest child, a teenager then, came into the room, the father, John, said, "Mary, we want you to know, Betty, because many years ago when your dad and mother had information about the FBI, we wanted the American public to know. We gave it to Betty." And I was utterly shocked.
Did they think that you knew?
Well, actually, they said at the time that they thought maybe I had figured it out. There was no way I could have done that. I never had any idea who the burglars were. And I actually didn't even give it much thought because I was concerned mostly about the substance once we found immediately that the documents were authentic. So that was the beginning of my thinking that this was an important story, important piece of history that wasn't known. How did this group of people find it possible to come up with the idea and carry it out? And shortly after that, I asked them if they would help me find the other burglars. They had all agreed to take this secret to their graves, and I asked them if they would reconsider their silence and come forward. And I wanted to tell the impact of what they had done.
Well, it's a fascinating story. Betty, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much.
That was Betty Metzger, author of The Burglary, The Discovery of J. Edgar Hoover's Secret FBI. Greg Coles has bestseller news. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Pamela.
What's new on the list this week?
Well, on the hardcover fiction list, there are four new titles. Starting at number five, the highest-ranked new title is called Lost Lake by a novelist named Sarah Addison Allen. She's been on the list before. This is actually her fourth bestseller. She writes these kind of homey, southern, gently magical realist novels like Hallmark movie versions of like Water for Chocolate. And this one is about a young widow who is trying to recover from her grief at kind of a magical Georgia resort owned by her family. Then at number seven, Armistead Maupin.
I like to say Maupin, but, you know, they might not say it that way in San Francisco.
Concludes his Tales of the City series with The Days of Anna Madrigal.
It's probably Maupin.
It probably is. He, of course, is a big-time San Francisco writer. This is a series that started actually as a serial fiction column in the San Francisco Chronicle. This concluding volume is about a 92-year-old transgender woman. Maupin is kind of like a gay Balzac. He writes these sprawling social novels about eccentrics and misfits
right.
in the San Francisco community. But he himself doesn't live in San Francisco anymore. He moved a couple of years ago to Santa Fe, which he called the gayest and worst dressed city in America. So it's perfect for me.
All right.
He said something like that.
Has one thing in common with San Francisco.
Then at number nine, Nancy Horan, who previously made the list with her first novel, Loving Frank, which was a story about Frank Lloyd Wright and his troubled marriage and his lover, Mama Cheney, has a new novel out called Under the Wide and Starry Sky that's about the troubled marriage of another famous artist figure, Robert Louis Stevenson, and his wife, Fanny. You get the feeling Nancy Horan is making a specialty out of these marriages that on Facebook would be called It's Complicated.
Right.
And then at number 16, the last new title on the hardcover fiction list this week is a new book by Charles Todd, the 16th book from Todd's Ian Rutledge series. I almost said from his Ian Rutledge series, but Charles Todd is actually two people. It's a mother-son writing team. So it's their Ian Rutledge series.
Wow, and they've done all 16 books together?
They have. The son's name actually is Charles Todd. His mother is Caroline. And yeah, they write these books together. They share an interest in history, obviously, in writing. It's funny, Charles Todd, before he started these books with his mother, had a career as a business consultant. And he writes on their website, "This experience gave him an understanding of going to troubled places where no one was glad to see him arrive. This was excellent training for Rutledge's reception as he tries to find a killer in spite of local resistance." Ian Rutledge, I should say, is a World War I Scotland Yard detective.
All right. A natural career transition.
Yeah. Then there's only one new book on the nonfiction side of things this week. It is new at number nine. It's a book called The Second Machine Age by a couple of MIT Sloan School of Management professors.
Because every book by MIT professors jumps immediately onto the bestseller list.
These authors are Eric Brynjolfsson and Andrew McAfee. The title of the book, The Second Machine Age, gives you a good sense of what it's about. It kind of looks at the new age of technology, Google cars and the Xbox Kinect and 3D printers and kind of the huge advances in computing power and technology, and looks at both the opportunities and the challenges that the new digital age presents.
All righty. Well, I guess on that, I don't know if it's an ominous note or an encouraging one. Thank you so much, Greg.
Sure. Thanks, Pamela.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.